Chapter 18. Unfortunate Visitors. Even as the taxi carried the diligent bookkeeper towards his encounter with the autonomously writing suit, a respectable passenger, carrying a small cardboard suitcase, stepped out, along with others, from the first-class sleeping car number 9 of the Kiev train arriving in Moscow. The passenger was none other than the late Berlioz's uncle, Maximilian Andreevich Poplavsky, an operational planning economist who lived on the former Institute Street in Kiev. The cause of Maximilian Andreevich's arrival in Moscow was a telegram he received late the night before yesterday, which contained the following. "I have just been run over by a tram on Patriarchs. Come funeral Friday, 3 p.m, Berlioz." Maximilian Andreevich was justly considered one of the smartest men in Kiev. However, even the smartest man is likely to be stumped by such a telegram. If a man telegraphs that he has been run over by a tram, then clearly he has not been killed. So why a funeral, then? Or perhaps he is very badly off and foresees his death. That's certainly possible, but the precision of the statement is extremely strange. Just how is he supposed to know that he will be buried Friday at 3 o'clock? Truly an astounding telegram. Fortunately, smart people exist to figure out convoluted things. Quite simple, there had been an error and the message was distorted in transmission. The word Berlioz had been transferred from the beginning of the telegram to the end. The word I came from some other telegram, and has took on the form of have. With this correction applied, the meaning of the telegram became clear, though, of course, tragic. When the burst of grief that engulfed his spouse subsided, Maximilian Andreevich immediately began to prepare for a trip to Moscow. We should reveal a certain secret about Maximilian Andreevich. Undoubtedly, he felt sorry for his wife's nephew, dead in the prime of life. However, as a practical man, he understood that there was little need for his presence at the funeral. And nonetheless, Maximilian Andreevich was in quite a hurry to get to Moscow. What was the matter? Just one thing. The apartment. An apartment in Moscow? That's serious business. Though we do not know why, Maximilian Andreevich did not like Kiev. And the thought of moving to Moscow had been gnawing at him so much recently that he had begun to lose sleep over it. He took no delight in the spring floods of the Dnieper, when engulfing the islands by its low-lying bank, the water became one with the horizon. He found no pleasure in the stunningly beautiful view that opened from the foot of Prince Vladimir's monument. He saw no cheer in the spots of springtime sunlight playing on the brick paths of Vladimir's hill. He did not want any of it. He wanted one thing: to move to Moscow. Ads in the papers regarding an exchange of an apartment on Institute Street in Kiev for a smaller one in Moscow produced no result. There were simply no takers, and on the rare occasion that someone called, the offers were disingenuous. The telegram shocked Maximilian Andreevich. Such an opportunity would be a sin to miss. Practical men know that opportunities like this come only once. In other words, no matter what the hardships, he had to inherit his nephew's apartment on Sadovaya. It would be difficult, yes, very difficult, but these difficulties had to be overcome at any cost. The experienced Maximilian Andreevich knew that his first and urgent step had to be the following. He absolutely had to, at least temporarily, register himself as a tenant in the 3 rooms of his deceased nephew. On Friday afternoon, Maximilian Andreevich passed through the door of the Tenants Association office of number 302B on Sadovaya Street in Moscow. An unshaven, middle-aged man with a disturbed look on his face sat in utter solitude at the wooden table in the narrow room. An old poster hung nearby on the wall, displaying the process of resuscitating victims of drowning through several illustrations. "May I see the chairman of the association?" the economist inquired politely, removing his hat and placing his suitcase on a vacant chair. This seemingly uncomplicated question upset the sitting man for some reason, so much so that his countenance changed. His eyes shifting, he muttered unintelligibly that the chairman was not in. "Is he in his apartment?" Poplavsky asked. "I have some urgent business." The sitting man again answered incoherently. One could infer, however, that the chairman was not home either. "When will he be back?" Staring at the window with anguish, the sitting man said nothing. "Aha!" the intelligent Poplavsky said to himself, and inquired about the secretary. The strange man behind the table grew purple with strain, and again said indistinctly that the secretary was also gone, that it was unclear as to when he would be back, and the secretary was ill. "Aha!" Poplavsky said to himself. "But surely there is someone left in the association?" "Me," the man said weakly. "You see," Poplavsky began commandingly, "I am the sole heir of the late Berlioz, my nephew, who, as you know, died on the Patriarchs, and it is my duty, in accordance with the law, to accept the inheritance consisting of apartment number 50.
"I'm not up to date on that, sir,"
the man interrupted sadly. "But forgive me," Poplavsky said loudly. "You are a member of the board and are responsible for..." And then another man entered the room. At the sight of the visitor, the sitting man grew pale.
"Board member, Piatnashko?"
the visitor asked the sitting man.
"Yes,"
the latter said in his weakest voice yet. The visitor whispered something to the sitting man, who rose from his chair, utterly upset. A few seconds later, Poplavsky was left alone in the empty room of the Tenants' Association.
"Oh, what a complication! That's just what I needed, all of them at once," Poplavsky thought resentfully, crossing the asphalt courtyard and hurrying to apartment number 50.
The door opened as soon as the economist rang the bell, and Maximilian Andreevich entered the dim hall. He was mildly surprised by the fact that whoever opened the door was nowhere to be seen. The hall was empty, save for an enormous black cat sitting on a chair. Maximilian Andreevich coughed, stamped his feet, and then the door of the study opened, and Korovyov stepped into the hall. Maximilian Andreevich bowed in a polite but dignified manner and said, "My name is Poplavsky. I am the uncle..." He did not have time to finish, for Korovyov pulled a dirty handkerchief from his pocket, stuck his nose in it, and began to cry.
"Of the late Berlioz?"
"Of course, of course,"
Korovyov interrupted, taking the handkerchief away from his face.
"I guessed it the moment I laid eyes on you."
Shaking with tears, he cried,
"What a tragedy, huh? I mean, what's going on here, huh?"
"Run over by a tram?" Poplavsky whispered.
"Completely!"
Korovyov shouted, and tears began to stream from under the pince-nez.
"Completely! I was a witness! Would you believe it? Slam! Off with the head! Right leg! Crunch into! Left leg! Crunch into! That's what these damned trams will do to you!"
And apparently unable to contain himself, Korovyov stuck his nose in the wall by the mirror and began to shudder with sobs. Berlioz's uncle was genuinely shocked at the behaviour of the unknown man. "And they say there are no more caring people these days," he thought, feeling his own eyes begin to itch. At the same time, however, an unpleasant little cloud came over his soul, and a tiny snake of a thought made him wonder whether the caring man had already registered himself in the apartment of the deceased, for such things, too, are known to happen in this life. "Forgive me, but were you a friend of my late Misha?" he asked, wiping his dry left eye with his sleeve, while studying the grief-stricken Korovyov with his right. But the latter was so entranced in his weeping that nothing coherent came out of him, save for the oft-repeated words,
"Crunch and in two!"
Having wept his fill, Korovyov peeled himself from the wall and pronounced,
"No, I can't take this any more. I'll go take 300 drops of valerian ether."
And, turning his completely tear-stained face to Poplavsky, he added,
"That's trams for you."
"I'm sorry, but did you send me the telegram?" Maximilian Andreevich asked, painfully racking his brain as to who this remarkable crybaby could be.
"He did,"
Korovyov replied, pointing to the cat. Poplavsky, eyes bulging, decided that he heard wrong.
"No, I just can't. I haven't the strength,"
Korovyov continued, sniffling.
"When I remember the wheel on his leg, one wheel alone weighs 400 pounds. Crunch! I shall go to bed, forget myself in sleep."
And he disappeared from the hall. Meanwhile, the cat stirred, jumped off the chair, stood on his hind paws with front akimbo, opened his mouth and said,
"Yeah, I sent the telegram, so what?"
Maximilian Andreevich's head instantly began to spin. His arms and legs went numb, and he dropped his suitcase and sat on a chair opposite the cat.
"I believe I asked you in Russian," the cat said sternly. "So what?"
But Poplavsky failed to produce a reply.
"Passport!"
the cat barked, extending a plump paw. Unable to comprehend or perceive anything except the two sparks burning in the feline eyes, Poplavsky tore the passport out of his pocket as if it were a dagger. The cat picked up a pair of spectacles with thick black frames from the mirror table, placed them on his muzzle, which served to give him an even more imposing look, and extracted the passport from Poplavsky's shaking hand.
"I wonder, am I going to faint or not?" thought Poplavsky.
Korofiov's sobs came from afar, and the entire hall filled up with the smell of ether, valerian, and some other nauseating filth.
"Which office issued this document?"
asked the cat, peering into the page. There was no reply.
412th,
the cat said to himself, tracing his paw along the passport, which he was holding upside down.
"Yes, of course, I know the place. They'll issue anyone a passport. As for me, I'd never have issued one to someone like you, under no circumstances. One look at your face and I'd have rejected you instantly."
The cat became so irate that he threw the passport to the floor.
"Your presence at the funeral is cancelled,"
he continued in official tones.
"Please be so kind as to return to your place of residence."
And he snarled at the door.
"Azazello!"
A small, limping man in black tights came running to the door at the cat's call, a knife tucked into his leather belt. He had red hair, a yellow fang, and a blemish in his left eye. Poplavsky felt a shortage of air. He rose from the chair and stepped back, clutching his heart.
"Azazello, see him off,"
the cat ordered and left the hall.
"Poplavsky,"
the new arrival said in a quiet nasal voice,
"I trust everything is clear by now."
Poplavsky nodded.
"Return to Kiev at once,"
Azazello continued.
"Lay low there, quiet as a mouse, and forget you ever thought about an apartment in Moscow. Got it?"
Though he barely reached to the economist's shoulder, the little man drove Poplavsky to mortal fear with his fang, knife, and crooked eye. He acted energetically, methodically, and efficiently. First of all, he picked up the passport and handed it to Maximilian Andreevich, who accepted the little booklet with a dead hand. Then the one named Azazello picked up the suitcase with one hand and opened the door with the other. Taking Berlioz's uncle under the arm, he led him out on the staircase landing. Poplavsky leaned against the wall. Azazello opened the suitcase without any key and took out an enormous fried chicken, wrapped in oily newspaper and missing a leg, and placed it on the landing. Then he extracted two pairs of underwear, a razor strop, some books and a case, and kicked everything except the chicken downstairs. The empty suitcase followed. It could be heard crashing below, where, judging by the sound, it had lost its lid. Immediately thereafter, the red-haired bandit picked up the chicken by the leg. Using the chicken's flat side, he dealt Poblavsky's neck a blow, so solid and frightening that the chicken's body popped right off, leaving the leg in Azazello's hands. As the renowned author Leo Tolstoy put it so well, everything grew jumbled in the house of Oblonsky. This is exactly what he would have said here. Yes, everything grew jumbled in Poblavsky's eyes. An elongated spark flashed before him, giving way to a weaving funereal stripe that briefly obscured the bright May day. And then Poblavsky found himself tumbling downstairs, passport in hand. Reaching a turn in the staircase, Poblavsky pushed the glass out of a window on the lower landing with his foot and sat down on a step. The legless chicken went hopping past and fell down the stairwell. Remaining upstairs, Azazello instantaneously devoured the chicken leg and placed the bone in the side pocket of his tights. He returned to the apartment and slammed the door shut. At the same time, the cautious steps of an ascending man came from below. Running down to the next landing, Poblavsky sat on a wooden bench there and caught his breath. A tiny, elderly man, with an extraordinarily sad face, stopped by Poblavsky on the way up. He was wearing an ancient tussle suit and a firm straw hat with a green band. "May I ask you, sir," the little man in tussle inquired mournfully, "where I might find apartment number 50?
"Upstairs," Poblavsky replied curtly.
"My humblest thanks, sir," the man replied just as mournfully, and continued up, while Poplavsky rose and ran downstairs. One naturally wonders whether Maximilian Andreevich was hurrying to complain to the police about the scoundrels who inflicted such savage violence upon him in broad daylight. The answer was, most assuredly, no. To enter a police station and say, "Look here, a cat in glasses has just been reading my passport, and then this man in tights with a knife." No, ladies and gentlemen, Maximilian Andreevich was truly a smart man. He was already at the bottom of the stairs by the exit when he saw a door leading to a small closet. The glass in the door was broken. Poblavsky concealed the passport in his pocket and looked around, hoping to find any scattered belongings. Unfortunately, they had all disappeared without a trace. Poblavsky was surprised at how little this bothered him. His mind was occupied by a much more interesting and enticing idea: trying out the accursed apartment on the little man. Indeed, as the man had inquired as to the whereabouts of the place, it stood to reason that it was his first visit there. Therefore, he was now headed straight into the claws of the gang that was holed up in apartment number 50. Something told Poblavsky that the little man would leave the apartment very soon. Naturally, Maximilian Andreevich had abandoned all plans to attend his nephew's funeral, and he still had plenty of time to catch the train back to Kiev. The economist glanced round and dived into the closet. At the same time, a door banged above. "That's him going in," thought Poblavsky, his heart skipping a beat. The closet was cool and reeked of mice and boots. Maximilian Andreevich sat down on a wooden block and decided to wait. The location was convenient, as the closet door offered a direct view of the front door. However, the Kievan visitor had to wait longer than he expected. For some reason, the staircase remained empty. He could hear everything quite well, and at last the door slammed again on the fifth floor. Poblavsky froze. Yes, those were his little steps. He's coming down. Another door opened a floor or so closer. The little steps stopped. A woman's voice? The sad man's voice? Yes, definitely his, saying something like, "Leave me alone, for Christ's sake." Protruding through the broken glass, Poblavsky's ear detected a woman's laughter. Quick and boisterous steps approaching. A glimpse of the woman's back. Carrying a green oilcloth bag in her hands, the woman went out of the front door and into the courtyard. Meanwhile, The little man's little steps resumed. That's odd. He's returning to the apartment. Or is he part of the same gang? Yes, he's going back. There's the upstairs door opening again. Very well. Let's wait a bit longer. This time the waiting was brief. The sound of the door, little steps, the steps pause, a desperate scream, the meowing of a cat. Quick little steps, staccato, down, down, down. Poplavsky got what he was waiting for. Crossing himself and muttering, the sad man flew past, his hat missing, his face utterly crazed, his bald head covered in scratches, and his pants soaked. He began to yank the front door handle, unable to determine in his panic whether it opened inwards or outwards. Finally, he overcame the door and bolted out into the sunny yard. The experiment was over. Forgetting both the deceased nephew and the apartment, shuddering at the thought of the danger he had been in, Maximilian Andreevich ran out into the courtyard, whispering but three words. "It's all clear. It's all clear." Several minutes later, a trolley carried the operational planning economist off towards the Kiev train station. As for the little man, a most unpleasant story happened to him while the economist was sitting in the closet downstairs. The man was a bartender and buffet keeper at the Variety and was known as Andrei Fokich Sokov. During the investigation at the Variety, Andrei Fokich kept to the side of all that went on. It was only noticed that he grew even sadder than usual, and furthermore, that he had questioned Karpov, the messenger, as to where the visiting magician was staying. And so, leaving the economist on the landing, the bartender reached the fifth floor and rang the bell of apartment number 50. Though the door opened instantly, the bartender quivered and balked at entering. This was understandable. The door had been opened by a girl, wearing nothing but a coquettish lacy apron and a white headdress, although she did have golden slippers on her feet. The girl was distinguished by her flawless build, and only the purple scar on her neck could have been considered a defect in her appearance. "Well, come in, since you rang," the girl said, fixing her dissolute green eyes on the bartender. Andrei Fokich gasped, blinked, and stepped into the hall, removing his hat. At the same time, a phone rang in the hall. Placing one foot on a chair, the shameless chambermaid took the phone off the hook and said, "Hello?" The bartender knew not where to look, shifting from foot to foot and thinking, "Some maid this foreigner has. Ooh, how obscene." And so as to save himself from the obscenity, he began to look sideways around him. The large, dimly lit hall was packed full of unusual items and clothing. A funeral cape lined with fiery fabric was draped over the back of a chair, and a long sword with a gleaming golden hilt lay upon the mirror table. Three other swords with silver hilts stood in a corner, as if they were mere canes or umbrellas. Caps adorned with eagle feathers hung from the deer antlers on the wall. "Yes," the maid was saying on the phone.
"Who?"
"Baron Magel. I'm listening."
"Yes, the artist is in today."
"Yes, he would be happy to see you."
"Yes, guests."
"A black suit or tailcoat?"
"What's that?"
"At midnight." Ending the conversation, the maid hung up and turned to the bartender.
"May I help you?"
"I must see the artist."
"What? Him personally?"
"Him,"
the bartender answered sadly.
"I'll ask,"
the maid said hesitantly, and opening the deceased Berlioz's office door a crack, she announced,
"Sir Knight, a little man is here asking for the Messiah."
"Let him enter," Korovyov's broken voice came from the office.
"Come into the living room,"
the maid said as nonchalantly as if she were decently dressed. She opened the door to the living room and left the hall. Following the invitation, the bartender entered the room and was so astonished by its decor that he nearly forgot why he came. Extraordinary. Church-like light poured through the large, stained-glass windows. A fancy of the jeweller's mysteriously missing wife. Despite the hot spring day, firewood blazed in the giant antique fireplace. The room was not the least bit hot, however. On the contrary, the cool dankness of a cellar enveloped the entering visitor. A black monster of a cat sat on a tiger skin in front of the fireplace, grinning contentedly at the fire. There was a table, which gave the God-fearing bartender a start. It was covered with an altar cloth. A multitude of round, mouldy, dusty bottles rested on the brocade tablecloth. A tray glinted among the bottles, and one could immediately see that it was made of solid gold. By the fireplace, a short, red-haired fellow with a knife tucked in his belt was roasting pieces of meat impaled on a long steel sword, the juice dripping into the fire and the smoke rising up the chimney. The smell of roasting meat mingled with the odour of strong perfume and incense. The bartender, having already heard of Berlioz's death from the papers and knowing where the man had lived, wondered for a split second whether a church service had perhaps been held here for the deceased, but then quickly chased the thought away as patently absurd. Suddenly, the stupefied bartender heard a low, heavy voice.
"So, what can I do for you?"
And then, in the shadows, he discovered the one he was looking for. The black magician was sprawled out on an immense, low couch with pillows strewn all over it. It seemed to the bartender that the artist was wearing only black underclothes and equally black pointed slippers.
"I am in charge of the buffet at the Variety Theatre," the bartender began bitterly.
His fingers sparkling with gemstones, the artist held out his hand as if to block the bartender's mouth, and spoke very emphatically,
"No, no, no, not a word more. Under no circumstances, and never again. I won't so much as taste anything that comes out of your buffet. I walked by your counter yesterday, my good sir, and to this moment I cannot forget either the sturgeon or the feta. My precious man, feta is not supposed to be green. Someone must have lied to you. It is meant to be white. Oh, and the tea. It is filth. With my own eyes, I saw some slovenly girl pour tap water from a bucket into your enormous samovar, and all the while tea was being served from it. No, my dearest fellow, that is unacceptable."
"Forgive me," said Andrei Fokich, stunned by this unexpected attack. "That's not why I'm here, and the sturgeon has nothing to do with it."
"What do you mean it has nothing to do with it if it's spoiled?"
"We were supplied sturgeon of second-grade freshness," the bartender informed.
"My friend, that's rubbish."
"What's rubbish?"
"Second-grade freshness. That's what. Freshness has only one grade, the first, also the last. If the sturgeon is second grade fresh, then it is, quite simply, rotten."
"Forgive me."
The bartender started again, unsure of how to shake off the nagging artist.
"I absolutely cannot forgive you,"
the latter said firmly.
"That is not why I'm here,"
the bartender said, now utterly upset.
"It's not,"
the foreign magician said, surprised.
"What other business could have brought you here? If my memory serves me well, I have only associated with a single member of your profession, a sutler woman, which was long before your appearance in this world. Nonetheless, I'm glad. Azazello, a chair for Sir Buffet Manager."
The man roasting the meat turned, terrifying the bartender with his fangs, and deftly handed him one of the low oaken stools. There were no other seats in the room.
"My humble thanks,"
the bartender uttered, and lowered himself onto the stool. Its back leg immediately cracked and broke. The bartender gasped and hit his behind painfully on the floor. As he fell, he hooked another stool in front of him with his foot, knocking over a chalice full of red wine on his pants.
"Oh, you aren't hurt, are you?"
the artist exclaimed. Azazello helped the bartender to his feet and gave him another seat. His voice full of grief, the bartender refused the host's offer to take off his pants and dry them off in front of the fire. Feeling extremely uncomfortable in the wet clothes, he sat down cautiously on the second stool.
"I like to sit low," the artist spoke. "It is not quite so dangerous to fall that way." "Yes, so we were talking about the sturgeon. My friend, freshness, freshness, and more freshness. This should be the motto of any buffet keeper. Why, here, won't you try this?"
A sword flashed before the bartender in the crimson light of the fireplace, and Azazello laid a sizzling piece of meat on a golden plate, sprayed it with lemon juice, and handed the bartender a two-pronged golden fork.
No, try it.
Out of politeness, the bartender put a small piece in his mouth and immediately tasted something truly fresh and, more importantly, incredibly delicious. As he chewed on the fragrant, juicy meat, however, the bartender nearly choked and almost fell over again. A large dark bird flew in from the neighbouring room and brushed the bartender's bald head lightly with its wing. Alighting on the mantelpiece near the clock, the bird turned out to be an owl. "Dear God," thought Andrei Fokich, a nervous man like all bartenders, "some place this is."
"A cup of wine? White? Red? Which nation's wine do you prefer at this time of day?"
I don't drink.
"Too bad. Perhaps a game of dice? Or do you prefer some other game? Dominoes? Cards?"
"I don't play," the bartender replied, growing weary.
"Most regrettable," the host concluded. "If you ask me, something sinister lurks in men who avoid wine, games, the company of lovely women, and dinner-time conversation. Such people are either gravely ill or secretly detest everyone around them. There are exceptions, of course. Among those who have sat at my banquet table, I've occasionally happened upon astonishing scoundrels. Anyway, let's hear about your business."
"Yesterday, you were so kind as to show some tricks."
"Me?" the magician exclaimed in amazement. "Please, that sort of thing is rather unbecoming to me."
"Forgive me," said the bartender, taken aback. "Why, the seance of black magic."
"Oh, well, yes, yes, my dear fellow. Let me reveal a secret to you. I am no artist. I merely wished to observe the Muscovites en masse, which was easiest to do in a theatre. Thus, my entourage."
He nodded at the cat.
"Put on that seance while I merely sat and looked at the Muscovites. But don't look so shocked. Tell me instead what it is about this seance that brings you here."
"If you please, among other things, some bills fell from the ceiling."
The bartender lowered his voice and looked round in embarrassment.
"Well, so everyone grabbed them. Then a young man comes to the buffet, gives me a 10. I give him 8.50 in change. Then another..."
"Also a young man?"
"No,
middle-aged, a third, a fourth. I keep handing out change. Today I checked the till, and instead of money, I saw pieces of paper. The buffet carried a loss of 109 rubles.
Ay, 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 exclaimed the artist. Surely they didn't think the bills were real? I cannot entertain the thought that they did this on purpose.
The bartender gave a crooked, miserable look, but said nothing.
Swindlers? Could it be?
The magician asked the guest anxiously.
Are there really swindlers among Muscovites?
The bartender smiled so bitterly in response that all doubt was cast aside. Yes, there were indeed swindlers among Muscovites.
How low, Volland said indignantly. You're a poor man. You're a poor man, aren't you?
The bartender hunched his head into his shoulders, showing that he was indeed a poor man.
How much do you have in savings?
Although the question was asked in sympathetic tones, one could not deny that it was somewhat tactless. The bartender hesitated.
249,000 rubles in 5 different banks,
came a cracked voice from the neighbouring room.
In addition to 200 gold 10 pieces under the floorboards in his house.
It was as if the bartender had fused with his seat.
Well, that is certainly next to nothing, Volant said condescendingly to his guest. Though, on second thought, you won't even need that. When will you die?
The bartender grew indignant.
That no one knows, and it's nobody's business, he replied.
No one knows? Ha!
The same rotten voice said from the study.
No binomial theorem, this one. He'll die in 9 months, in February of next year, from cancer of the liver in the first Moscow State University clinic in ward number 4.
The bartender's face turned yellow.
9 months, Volant counted pensively. 249,000 comes out to roughly 27,000 a month. A little scarce, but sufficient for a modest lifestyle. Plus those 10 pieces.
The 10 pieces will not be cashed,
the same voice put in, chilling the bartender's heart.
Upon Andrei Fukich's death, the house will be torn down immediately, and the 10 pieces will be repossessed by the state bank.
Oh, and I would advise against going to a clinic, the artist continued. What's the point in dying in a hospital ward to the moaning and gasping of the hopelessly ill? Would it not be better to throw a feast on these 27,000 and with a bit of poison journey to the other world to the sound of music, surrounded by drunken beauties and dashing friends?
The bartender sat very still and suddenly looked a lot older. Dark rings surrounded his eyes, his cheeks sagged, and his lower jaw dropped.
However, we digress, exclaimed the host. To business. Show me your pieces of paper.
The agitated bartender extracted a package from his pocket, unwrapped it, and was dumbfounded. Inside the piece of newspaper lay 10-ruble bills.
My dear fellow, you truly are ill, said Volant, shrugging his shoulders.
Smiling insanely, the bartender rose from his seat.
But, he spoke, stuttering, what if they, you know, again?
The artist pondered. Well, in that case, come right back. You're always welcome here. Glad to have made your acquaintance.
Kuroviov immediately jumped out of the study, snatched the bartender's hand, and began shaking it, all the while begging Andrei Fukich to give his regards to everyone, absolutely everyone,
Very confused, the bartender started for the hall.
Hello, see him out,
shouted Korovyov. Again, the naked redhead in the hall. The bartender squeezed himself through the door, squeaked out a goodbye, and stumbled off like a drunk. Descending a short distance, he stopped, sat down on the stairs, took out his bundle, and checked it. The money was there. Just then, a woman carrying a green bag came out of an apartment on the landing. Seeing a man sitting on the stairs and staring obtusely at some tens, she smiled at him and said pensively, "What a house we've got. Day's barely started, and this one's already drunk. Someone's knocked out the glass on the landing again." Looking at the bartender more closely, she added, "Hey, looks like you've got money to burn, mister. You ought to share some with me, eh?" "Leave me alone, for Christ's sake," said the bartender, frightened, and promptly hid the money. The woman laughed.
"Go to hell, you miser, I was just joking."
And she went downstairs. The bartender rose slowly, raised a hand to adjust his hat, and determined that it was missing from his head. He loathed the idea of going back, but regretted the loss of the hat. Hesitating for a moment, he nonetheless returned and rang.
"What else do you need?" asked the accursed Heller.
"I forgot my hat," the bartender whispered, gesturing at his bald head. Heller turned around, causing the bartender to mentally spit in disgust and close his eyes. When he opened them, Heller was holding out his hat and a sword with a dark hilt. "Not mine," the bartender whispered, pushing away the sword and quickly putting on the hat.
"You came without a sword?" Heller asked, surprised.
The bartender grumbled something in response and headed quickly down the stairs. His head felt unusually uncomfortable and hot inside the hat. He took it off and shrieked quietly, jolting in fear. In his hands lay a velvet beret with a tattered rooster feather. The bartender crossed himself. Immediately, the beret meowed and turned into a black kitten. Leaping back onto Andrei Fukich's head, the kitten plunged all of his claws into its bald surface. Emitting a desperate scream, the bartender dashed downstairs, while the kitten fell off his head and sprinted back up the steps. Bursting outside, the bartender trotted to the gate, forever leaving the accursed number 302B. It is well known what happened to him thereafter. Rushing through the gateway, the bartender glanced round wildly, as if looking for something. A minute later, he was in the drugstore on the opposite side of the street. No sooner did he utter, "Tell me, please," than the woman behind the counter exclaimed,
"Mister, your head's all cut up."
Several minutes later, the bartender had been bandaged with gauze and had found out that the best liver disease specialists were the professors Bernadsky and Kuzmin. Asking who was closer, he lit up with joy upon finding out that Kuzmin lived barely a block away in a small white house. In a couple of minutes he was there. The place was ancient, but very, very cosy. The first person the bartender would recall meeting was an old nurse who wanted to take his hat, but as he had none, she walked off somewhere, making chewing motions with her empty mouth. She was replaced by a middle-aged woman who appeared by the mirror under a sort of arch and immediately announced that the earliest available appointment was on the 19th. The bartender quickly saw a way out. Peeping through the arch with dying eyes, where three people waited in what was evidently the lobby, he whispered, "Terminally ill." The woman looked quizzically at the bartender's bandaged head, hesitated, and said, "Well then," and let the bartender through the arch. At the same time, the door on the opposite side of the room opened, and a golden pince-nez flashed in the doorway. The woman in the white coat said, "Folks, this patient will go first." And before the bartender knew it, he was in Professor Kuzmin's office. There was nothing frightening, nothing solemnly medical in this oblong room. "What's the problem?"
Professor Kuzmin asked pleasantly, glancing at the bartender's bandaged head with a certain degree of anxiety.
"I've just learned from a reliable source,"
the bartender replied, staring frantically at some framed group photograph,
"that I am going to die of cancer of the liver come February next year. I beg you to stop it."
Professor Kuzmin leaned right back in his tall leather gothic chair. "Forgive me, I don't quite understand. Have you been to a doctor? Why is your head bandaged?"
"What doctor? You ought to have seen that doctor."
The bartender's teeth suddenly began chattering.
"Never mind the head, it's unrelated," he replied. "Forget the head, it has nothing to do with it. It's cancer of the liver, I beg you to stop it."
"But, excuse me, who told you this?"
"Believe him,"
the bartender implored passionately.
"If anyone knows, he knows."
"I don't understand a thing," said the professor, shrugging his shoulders and gliding away from the desk on his chair. "How can he know when you'll die, especially since he is not a doctor?"
"In ward number 4,
the bartender replied. The professor looked over his patient, his head, his damp trousers, and thought, "Now, that's the last thing I need, a basket case." "Do you drink vodka?" he asked.
"Never touch it," replied the bartender.
A minute later, he lay undressed on a cold oilcloth couch while the professor poked at his stomach. This seemed to cheer up the bartender considerably. The professor categorically insisted that, at least for the moment, the bartender did not show any signs of cancer, but, given the situation, since he is afraid, since some charlatan frightened him, he should have all the proper tests done. The professor scribbled on pieces of paper, explaining where to go and what to bring. In addition, he wrote a note for Professor Burette, a neuropathologist, explaining to the bartender that his nerves were utterly shot.
"How much do I owe you, Professor?"
asked the bartender, in a tender, trembling voice, pulling out a fat wallet.
"As much as you like,"
the professor replied curtly and dryly. The bartender pulled out 30 rubles and placed them on the table. Then, suddenly, with a soft cat paws motion, he laid a jingling stack wrapped in newspaper over the 10s.
"What's this now?"
asked Kuzmin, twirling his moustache. "Don't be squeamish, Mr. Professor," the bartender whispered. "I beg you, stop the cancer." "Take back your gold at once," said the professor, feeling proud of himself. "You ought to look after your nerves instead. Submit a urine sample for analysis first thing tomorrow. Avoid drinking lots of tea, and eliminate all salt from your diet."
"Not even in the soup?"
asked the bartender. "No salt in anything," Kuzmin ordered. The bartender exclaimed wistfully. He looked at the professor affectionately, picked up the gold 10 pieces, and backed out the door. The professor saw few patients that evening, and the last one left just at the onset of twilight. Taking off his coat, the professor glanced at the spot where the bartender had left the money. But instead of the 10s, he found 3 labels from bottles of Abrodurso.
"Hell knows what's going on,"
Kuzmin muttered, dragging his coat across the floor and examining the labels.
"Apparently he's not only a schizophrenic, but also a cheat.
But I cannot imagine what he wanted from me. Surely not the urine test prescription."
"Ah, he stole the overcoat."
The professor dashed into the lobby, one arm still in the sleeve of his coat.
"Xenia Nikitishna," he shouted piercingly in the doorway. "Are all the coats there?"
It was determined that all the coats were there. However, upon finally tearing off his white coat and returning to his desk, the professor froze to the parquet floor, his eyes glued to the desk surface. An orphaned black kitten, with a miserable little face, sat where the bottle labels had been, meowing over a saucer of milk.
"What's going on here? This is getting..."
The professor felt a chill run up his spine.
Xenia Nikitishna came running at the professor's quiet, mournful cry and reassured him completely, guessing right away that, clearly, one of the patients must have left the kitten, as it often happens in professors' offices. "They live poorly, in all likelihood," Xenia Nikitishna explained, "whereas you..." They started wondering and pondering who might have left the kitten. Suspicion fell on an old lady with a stomach ulcer. "Of course it's her," Xenia Nikitishna said. "She's thinking, I am dying anyway, but why should the poor kitty?"
"But hold it a second," Kuzmin shouted. "What about the milk? Also her? And the saucer?"
"She brought some milk in a little bottle, poured it into a saucer," Xenia Nikitishna clarified.
"In any case, remove both the kitten and the saucer," said Kuzmin, personally following Xenia Nikitishna to the door. When he returned, the situation had changed. Hanging his coat on a hook, the professor heard laughter outside. Looking out of the window, he was, quite naturally, dumbstruck. A lady, wearing nothing but a shirt, was running across the yard towards an outbuilding on the other side. The professor even knew her name, Maria Alexandrovna. A boy turned out to be the source of the laughter.
"What's this all about?" Kuzmin said contemptuously. On the other side of the wall, in a room belonging to the professor's daughter, a gramophone began playing the foxtrot Hallelujah, and at the same moment a chirping came from behind the professor. He spun round and saw a large sparrow hopping on his desk. "Stay calm," thought the professor. "He flew in as I turned away from the window. Everything is fine," he told himself, feeling that everything was far from fine, and mostly on account of the sparrow. Taking a closer look, the professor quickly determined that he was no ordinary sparrow. The little bastard of a bird was leaning on his left leg, clowning, dragging it, syncopating. In other words, he was dancing to the foxtrot like a drunkard by the bar. Glancing at the professor insolently, he was as vulgar as a sparrow could be. Kuzmin's hand felt for the telephone, and he decided to call his one-time classmate Buret to ask just what it meant to see sparrows like this at the age of 60 and when one's head was spinning as well. Meanwhile, the sparrow perched on an inkwell the professor had received as a gift and befouled it. I'm not joking. Then the bird flew up, froze in the air, and accelerating towards the photograph of the university graduating class of 94, rammed the glass with a steel-like beak and shattered it into tiny pieces before flying out of the window. The professor changed his mind and dialed a different number. Rather than calling Buret, he telephoned the Medical Leech Supply Bureau, stated that he was Professor Kuzmin, and asked for an urgent delivery of leeches to his house. Hanging up, the professor turned back towards his desk and immediately let out a scream. A woman, wearing a nurse's cap, was sitting at the desk holding a bag labelled leeches. The professor screamed as he looked at her mouth. It was a man's mouth, crooked, stretched out from ear to ear with a single jutting fang. The nurse's eyes were dead.
"I'll just grab the cash,"
the nurse said in a deep male voice.
"No sense leaving it lying around."
She gathered up the labels with a bird-like claw and began to dissolve in the air. 2 hours passed. Professor Kuzmin was sitting on his bed in the bedroom, and leeches were hanging from his temples, his ears, and his neck. Grey-haired Professor Buret was sitting on a silk-quilted blanket at Kuzmin's feet, gazing at him compassionately and reassuring him that it was all stuff and nonsense. Outside, it was already night. What other oddities transpired in Moscow that night, we know not, and we certainly will not pry, especially since it is time for us to move on to the second part of this truthful narrative. Follow me, reader.